Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers, and $30 coin packs are on sale for 10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Never go to the second location. Always trust your gut.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. Here on Residue, we tell you the truth behind your favorite movies, and you all know that I am a huge fan of 80s made-for-TV movies, and today we will be talking about one of the most disturbing made-for-TV movies of all time, David, starring Matthew Lawrence as David Rothenberg. Born David Rothenberg, he later changed his name to Dave as an adult in an effort to separate himself from the tragedy that defined much of his life. So this is a very disturbing story, but it is a true story of survival. Thank you so much for joining me here today. And before we begin, you know you can follow me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, TikTok at Residue A True Crime Podcast, and Facebook, Residue A True Crime Podcast. Thank you all so much for the support you have been showing me. I recently had a listener named Sarah, who follows me on Facebook, tell me that she was listening to the podcast while she was getting a tattoo the other day, and that one of my episodes made her tear up a little bit, and her tattoo artist asked her what was wrong. Is she hurting her? Like, is it the tattoo? And she said, no, I'm listening to Residue, and they listened to it together while she got her tattoo, and I'm getting chills just thinking about that. That is, I just can't believe that the podcast has come this far and there is so much support, and it makes me so happy. It made my day to hear that. So I love hearing those kinds of things, especially when you send me DMs or you send me lovely messages on Spotify. It's just, it means everything. And I just want to thank you again. I know I would be thanking you forever if I could. Thank you, Resi Crew. You are amazing. Before we begin, I just have to let you know one more time, this is such a disturbing story. It's very difficult to tell. There are going to be discussions that might be really difficult to listen to. So I understand if you want to skip this episode and come back next week. If you have seen the made-for-TV movie from 1988, you understand what you're getting yourself into here. But before we begin, please note that this episode contains discussions of child abuse, attempted filicide, and severe injuries to a child. Listener discretion is advised. The 1988 TV movie David is one of the most emotionally devastating made-for-TV movies of the 1980s, of all time. It dramatizes the real-life story of David Rothenberg, a six-year-old boy who survived after his father, Charles Rothenberg, deliberately set him on fire in a California motel room in 1983. This film premiered on ABC on October 25th, 1988. This made-for-TV movie was based on a book written by David's mother, Marie Rothenberg, and Mel White. And the casting was incredibly widely praised for this film. Bernadette Peters as Marie Rothenberg, John Glover as Charles Rothenberg, and Matthew Lawrence as David Rothenberg. Matthew Lawrence was only 8 years old when he portrayed David, and many viewers remember his performance as surprisingly mature and heartbreaking. Many critics singled out Bernadette Peters' portrayal of Marie Rothenberg. At the time, Bernadette Peters was best known for musical theater and lighter roles, so her performance as a mother navigating unimaginable trauma surprised audiences. For a network television production in 1988, the burn makeup was considered effective, remarkably effective. The film received Emmy nominations, including recognition for its makeup work. Because most of the movie shows David wrapped in bandages, undergoing treatment, and gradually revealing the extent of his injuries. And many viewers who watched it as children in the 1980s, myself included, I think I was about 10 years old when I watched this movie, and it scared the living hell out of me. Images from that movie are so vivid in my mind, even decades later. People still talk about this movie today because for many Gen X and older millennial viewers, David belongs to a group of these unforgettable 1980s TV movies that were based on true crime. I mean, it's what Residue is all about. You know, alongside films like I Know My First Name is Steven and Adam, this left a lasting impression because it dealt with dangers facing children in a very direct way. David maintains a solid reputation with viewers frequently describing it as one of the most memorable TV movies of the era. Marie and Charles Rothenberg had been divorced nearly 5 years and shared custody of their 6-year-old son, David. In February of 1983, Charles approached Marie and asked if he could take David on a short vacation. He explained that he would soon be starting a new job and he wanted to spend some quality time with his son before his work began. Now, Marie had never refused Charles' visitations with David. She trusted him to take their son to and from school and to daycare. He was even invited over for dinner on occasion, so there was no obvious reason for her to worry. Yet when Charles arrived at her front door to pick up David, Marie felt an uneasy sense of fear that she just couldn't quite explain. Something about the situation felt different this time. In her book, David's Story, which was my main source for today's episode, Marie states that Charles was a proud father. Charles was raised in an orphanage. His mother had given him up very young for adoption, and he really had this deep wound that he didn't belong to anyone. What made him feel even worse was the fact that his mother would still come and visit him sometimes. I mean, she left him in this orphanage, but she would come and visit. And he was quoted as saying, "This was more painful than not having a mother at all, because it left no question for the other children and himself that he was unwanted." Marie describes Charles as a charming, handsome man. He knew what to say. He knew how to say it. And he was a man that had a long criminal record. Now, Marie did not find out that her husband had a long criminal record until about a month after they were married. She found out that Charles was wanted by the FBI for forging a check for $23,000. And she would ask herself, now, how could I fall for a man like this? Well, it was because he was charming. He love-bombed her while Marie was at her deepest, darkest. She was so lonely, living in New York City all by herself, and along comes this handsome, charming man who just swept her off her feet. Marie grew up in a very volatile environment. Both her mom and later her stepmom abused her. Her father died at a young age while she was living in Pennsylvania, and Marie moved to New York City as a teenager to escape all of this abuse, and she struggled in New York City, barely surviving on her own until she met Charles. Now, he begged her to move to San Francisco with him, and she did. And once she was in San Francisco and they were thriving, she was thriving, she was making friends, he said, "Nope, we're moving back to New York City now." And once again, Marie packed up all of her things and moved back to New York City. And she came to realize that Charles was a very irresponsible and intense man who just couldn't sit still. He couldn't stay in one place too long, and he was very prone to outburst. When they got back to New York City, they were married in a civil court in Brooklyn, and Charles opened up a laundromat business. But little did Marie know that he started that business with the $23,000 that the FBI was after him for. So 30 days after they were married, Charles was finally caught and arrested. And one of the FBI agents looked straight into Marie's eyes and said, "Girl, you better do yourself a favor. You better walk away from this guy. He is no good. Get as far away from him as you can." After he was caught, Charles spent 9 months in prison, and then he was released on a work furlough program in San Francisco. And while he was there in San Francisco, Marie came to visit him, and that is when their baby David was conceived. 3 months after, Charles returned to New York City, and on June 18th, 1976, David Rothenberg was born. Instantly, from the second he was born, there was nothing that Charles wouldn't do for his son, or let his son do. Charles spoiled the hell out of David. Charles was working 12 to 14 hour days as a waiter, 6 days a week. He had 1 day a week off, and during that time off, he would spend it with David. And now Marie states in her memoir that there was a dark side to this love. He refused to let David cry, and this resulted in David becoming unmanageable by age two. Marie recalls the night before David's second birthday. David is throwing this god-awful, horrible tantrum, and she just put him in his room, put him in his bed, because her doctor said, "Hey, listen, you're going to need to let the little boy cry, because that's the only way he's going to learn how to calm himself down." So she hated doing it, but she sat next to his bedside, she left him in the bed, and she let him cry it out, because she knew that that is what he needed. But during this tantrum, Charles comes home from work. He's already pissed off after a long day, and mid-David tantrum, Charles loses his mind. He goes into the room. He could not believe that Marie was just sitting there letting their baby cry. He barges in and he throws Marie up against a wall right in front of their child. He picked David up in his arms and he rocked him to sleep for the next hour. Marie, at this point, she is very young, and David is her first child. She was struggling to understand how to parent. After David falls asleep that night, Charles rages out of that room. Marie is sitting on the couch in the living room with a cup of tea. He goes straight for her, throws the cup of tea out of her hand, throwing it across the carpet, grabs her by the neck, rips off her nightgown, and throws her to the ground, kicking her. The couple was divorced not very long after this abusive incident. And Marie was afraid of Charles at this point, but she said she had absolutely no reason to fear that he would hurt their son. So after the divorce, Charles seemed to be the perfect father to everyone around them. Teachers, even the school principal at David's school, said that Charles was this amazing, perfect father, always doting on David. So Marie thought everything was okay. I mean, he's abusive towards her, but he's not going to hurt their son. And now, in February of 1983, Marie has agreed to let Charles spend a week with his son while he's waiting for his job to begin. And Charles arrived at Marie's apartment on a Sunday night in February, looking very well-dressed and really excited. He seemed like he was in a great mood. He was stoked to be spending a week with his son. And Charles informed Marie they're going to the Catskills. They're going to be spending the weekend in the Catskills, going to a game farm. And Marie recalls that at that moment, when he said that to her, she thought something was up because it was February. It's the Catskills. They're not open in the winter. So she felt uneasy. She felt a little more uneasy when Charles started ordering her around her own apartment, which, by the way, she shared with her new fiancé, John Cirillo, who was a police officer. So Charles was yelling at Marie, telling her that she didn't pack enough clothes, they needed extra shoes, they needed extra shirts, and she was a little confused because her and Charles, at this point, only lived about 2 blocks away from each other. So she knew they were going to the Catskills for just the weekend, but she thought, well, while you're home from Monday through Friday, if you need more stuff, you can just come here or you can call me and I'll bring it to you. This whole exchange with her ex-husband made her feel really uneasy. And after he left the apartment with their son, David, she called her fiancé, John, and talked to him about these feelings of uneasiness. John was trying to calm her down. He was trying to make her feel better about the situation. He reassured her that Charles is a great father. He's going to take great care of David. He loves him, Marie. He will take care of him. You know that. And he asked what exactly worried her. She said, "Well, I know this man. I have seen that look in his eyes before." She then tells John where they were going. She says, "Hey, they're going to the Catskills for the weekend. They're going to visit a game farm." And there's silence on the phone call. And John says, "Marie, they cannot be going to the Catskills because the Catskills are closed for the season." Marie was frantic. She immediately calls Charles' house. There's no answer. She calls the restaurant that he was working at this time. And it was then that she found out that they hadn't seen Charles at all. Actually, they had the police issue a warrant for Charles' arrest because he had already been fired for misconduct. They didn't tell her for what, but Marie assumed this meant that he was fired for theft again. Marie knew that Charles wasn't going on a vacation. Charles was trying to dodge the police again, just like he had always done back in the day with Marie. They would jump from New York City to San Francisco when he was wanted by the FBI then. And now there's another warrant out for his arrest. So she's putting two and two together. And she's like, that man took my son to escape the police once again. So she calls her brother-in-law and together, they race to Charles's apartment. They're banging on his door. They're screaming his name. And a landlady comes out to talk to them. She tells them, "Charles is gone. This man, Charles, he was rushing around like a crazy person today. He was throwing away everything into the dumpster. He's throwing away boxes. He's throwing away pictures." And then she tells Marie, "He threw away pictures of their son, David. He ripped those pictures to shreds and then threw them into the dumpster." And just like the FBI agent years ago, this landlady is telling Marie, "This man is no good. You should not be near this man. You should not let your son near this man." They call the police and they immediately arrive to the scene, Charles's apartment. Marie tells them that her son has been with her ex-husband for 5 days. So at this point, he's basically missing for 5 days. She thought he was having a good time with his dad. They go into Charles's apartment, and the first thing they see is a note taped to the back of the door that read, "Here are your keys. I will not be returning." And Marie just collapses, sobbing hysterically, and keeps saying over and over, "He took my baby." Of course, they immediately filed a missing persons report, but police tell Marie that they're not going to be able to help her. She's going to have to go through the family courts, and they say that there are no channels for this type of, quote, misunderstanding. That's why Marie loses her shit and she starts protesting. "This is not a misunderstanding. This is not a misunderstanding. This man kidnapped my child." She was enraged. She was so fired up that she's telling the police officers, "You get out there and you find my baby. You figure out how to do it." So police, they agree to bypass the whole family courts system, and they immediately assigned a detective to David's case. And there was an all-points bulletin released with depictions of Charles and David. Now that there is an all-point bulletin going out, and Charles is going to soon find out that everyone's on the lookout for him, Marie anticipated that Charles would call her. Maybe he would want to get in touch with her, let her know what was going on. But days go by and there is no call. Marie is tired of sitting around her apartment, just not knowing what is going on, freaking out. So she decides, "I'm going to go to my office," because sometimes Charles would call me at lunchtime at my desk. So she goes into her office and she sits there and she waits. And he did. He called her around lunchtime. And I'm going to read you what he said to her on that phone call. So she picked up the phone and he just simply said, "Hi, Marie. very calmly. He was not anxious. He just sounded like he's having a normal day. She says, "Charles, where are you? What have you done with David? Let me talk to him." "You can't, Marie." "Why not?" Charles tells her it's because David's asleep, and Marie gets so upset. Like, why is David still asleep at noon? It's lunchtime. What is he doing in bed? And Charles stutters, and he makes a mistake right here, and he goes, "It's the time different." And he stops himself, and he pulls it back, and then Marie's like, "What do you mean? What about the time? Where are you, Charles?" Then she remembers that Charles asked if he could take David out of school for a trip to Disney World, and she said no. She was like, "Hell no." But there's no time difference between Florida and New York. So she's like, "Are you in California?" And she's got him. "Are you visiting Disneyland?" Of course, Charles lies to her. He's like, "Of course not, Marie. Of course I'm not in California. What are you, crazy? I'm in upstate New York. I'm on a farm, and you're never going to be able to find me." And she's like, "Please, let me talk to my son." He says no, and the line goes dead. But Charles called back, and he says, "Marie, David would like to talk to you right now, but he's too busy." So what kind of creepy game is this man trying to play with the mother of this child? He is now saying, "You know what? He really does want to talk to you, but no, he's a little too busy. He's playing video games." And of course, Marie's like, "Well, get him off the video games and tell him to come talk to his mother." And he says, "Absolutely not. I'm sorry. He's much too busy." Charles tells Marie that he's going to keep David for a while. And now Marie will later say that she doesn't really remember what she said to Charles in this moment because it was just pure hysteria on her end. He claimed later to a newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, that she told him if and when he did return their son David to Brooklyn, he's never going to see him again. And that just broke Marie because she didn't remember saying that. But she couldn't say for sure if she did or not because she was so hysterical in that moment. And what Charles is saying in that Los Angeles Times interview is that he blames the fact that he tried to kill their son on her being hysterical and saying that once David was returned home, Charles is never going to see him again. Before Charles hangs up, he tells Marie he's going to call back tonight at 7 p.m. So she calls police, tells them everything, and they tell her, "Listen, when he does call again, we need you to promise anything." She needs to go along with whatever he is saying. She needs to stay calm, and she needs to figure out a way for him to get David on that phone to talk to her to make sure that David is okay. Charles never called back that night. This was a Tuesday. The next day, Wednesday, no call at all. Marie just sat at that work desk, and the police had the phones tapped. They were just waiting. But then on Thursday, there is a phone call. Marie picks it up and the line goes dead. The police inform her, "That was David. He was calling you, but we lost the line and it went dead." 20 minutes later, the phone rings again, but this time it wasn't Charles. It was a Western Union operator. Now this operator, she had a telegram that she had to read to Marie Rothenberg. And this operator's voice was trembling. She sounded scared. She said, "Mrs. Rothenberg, I have a telegram for you. May I read it?" And Marie said the operator sounded as though she was about to cry. Marie tells her, "Yes, go ahead and read it." "Dear Marie, by the time you read this, I will have terminated my existence. You have caused me enough harm. I've gone through enough." The operator continued to say, "Also, be informed that your son has been in an accident and is in the University of California at Irvine Medical Center, Burn Center." David was at a nearby hospital in Orange County where doctors immediately began emergency treatment. And given the extent of his injuries, his chances of survival appeared very slim. He had suffered devastating burns over 90% of his body, along with inhalation injuries that put him at risk of respiratory failure and shock. Medical staff worked around the clock to stabilize him, and he underwent extensive wound care, including painful removal of dead tissue, while doctors prepared for the skin grafts and reconstructive surgeries that would follow. And for weeks, David remained in critical condition. To reduce the risk of infection, he was kept in isolation and remained heavily bandaged from head to toe. The daily treatments were agonizing, and because of his injuries, he was unable to speak for more than a month. And despite this grim prognosis, David continued to fight. By early April, after several weeks of intensive care, he began regaining consciousness and showing signs of recovery, something many doctors thought was unlikely. In the early 1980s, children with burns as severe as David's rarely lived through such injuries. Yet against all odds, he endured. In her memoir, Marie Rothenberg writes, "There will never be enough reasons to answer the question, why? Why did Charles try to murder our son that night in hotel room 139? Marie was interviewed by People magazine, and she said, "When I went into the hospital room, I didn't think it was David because he was so badly swollen. He was three times his normal size. His head was like a huge balloon. I thought it was a teenager in the bed. He was bandaged from head to toe and smeared all over with creams. His eyes were so badly burned, they popped out of his head. His fingers were black and bloody, and his lips were gone. He was conscious, but he couldn't see or talk. I had never seen anybody suffering to that extent. I felt that he should die." Marie blamed herself for what Charles did to their son. And she said that Charles did this because he didn't want me to have David. He would have rather seen his son dead than have him return to me. Charles Rothenberg was arrested on March 3rd, 1983. He was arrested at a YMCA in San Francisco, and he said to police, "If I can't have him, nobody can." Charles claimed that he originally intended to kill himself as well as his son. On the night of March 2nd, Charles gave his 6-year-old son David a pill. He told him it was a pain reliever, but this was a sleeping pill. After David fell asleep, Charles stood over his 6-year-old son and poured 2.5 gallons of kerosene around the bed and the bedspread. There were witnesses that night at the Travelodge. A woman named Maisel Nadine Coons, she was a guest staying at that Travelodge, and her room was on the 2nd floor. It was adjacent to and above the room where Charles and David were staying. And this witness says that she looked out her front window to see if it was still raining, and she saw a white car backed into the stall directly in front of room 139. So she noticed it because the door on the driver's side was open and the engine was running. And then she sees Charles come running out of that hotel room. He was carrying a large white jug. She said that she saw him walk to a trash can, throw the jug into the trash can, and then he returned to room 139 and bent over as if to pick something up just inside the room. He stood up, closed the door, and walked quickly to the white car. She said that she saw him slam the door of the white car, and he drove at least 40 miles an hour through that parking lot toward the street. As she is witnessing all this, by the time Charles is about halfway through the parking lot, she hears a loud explosion and the window of room 139 blows out and flames come rushing out of the window. She said she could hear screams coming from inside of the burning room. Now, a man comes along and he begins to kick down this hotel room door, and these flames are just jumping out at him. So someone else runs up to help this man, and they grab a chemical fire extinguisher and they start spraying this burning room. They can hear David screaming for help, and then they can hear that David's screams have stopped. They see David lying on his back on the floor at the foot of the bed with his head and hands towards the open doorway. And then a man named Jeffrey Michelin, he was a Chicago businessman who was staying at this travel lodge on business. He heard all of this happening, so he ran to the scene. And there were still two unidentified men already there fighting their way through these flames to help drag David out of this room and to safety. They were just not able to get in. They kept getting beaten back by this fire. Then this Jeffrey Michelin, he enters the room on his hands and knees and pulls David out of the way of the flames, drags him out of that hotel room. These people are heroes. And it reminds me of that Fred Rogers quote where he said that his mother told him that if he ever saw scary or tragic things in the news, that you should just always look for the people that are stepping in to assist during a crisis. Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping. Marie Rothenberg writes in her memoir that since that night that David was brought into the hospital, she has spent more than a year in and around the intensive care units of the UCI Burn Center and of the Shriners Children's Hospital in Boston. She has seen these wonderfully trained medical teams work to save other children brought in screaming in the middle of the night. Marie recalls that one of the nurses that her and David actually grew to love remembers looking down at David and saying out loud, "There is no way that this kid is going to make it." But Marie was like, "You don't know my son. David is a fighter and his will to survive is strong." Charles Rothenberg was sentenced in July of 1983 to 13 years in prison. Just 13. This was the maximum that was permitted at the time of these offenses. The judge presiding over this case, he did an interview with the LA Times, and he said that this is a case that you do not forget. He says that he wishes he could have given him more time, more than 7 years. He stated, "I mean, why can't I even offer protection to this boy and the security of knowing his father could never hurt him again? If you're asking me, I would have given him life in prison. You bet I would have. You bet I would have. He would have died in prison if I had anything to say about it. No question, no question." Because Charles Rothenberg was out of prison after 7 years. He was released in 1990 and placed on 3 years supervised parole after serving only 7 years. David returned home to Brooklyn after 6 months of surgeries to graft skin on third-degree burns over 90% of his body. And David's mom said he was really scared to go home. He was afraid of what his friends would think of him, if they would be scared of him. But so many people love David. There were over 200 people waiting at his home in Brooklyn to welcome him home. There was a sign that read, "You are one special kid, David. We are so glad to have you home." I mean, David became a national treasure. He was a survivor. He was now a celebrity. He survived this insanely horrific tragedy, and everyone wanted to celebrate him. I mean, he was on the cover of People magazine. He was on TV daytime talk shows. He was friends with famous people like Michael Jackson. They became like best friends. He was friends with Reggie Jackson. Politicians were talking to him. The Kennedys were all about David. When David was on the daytime TV talk show, Lisa, he talked about his relationship with Michael Jackson, saying that they bonded over many things, that their friendship was real because Michael actually grew up with an abusive father too. Michael knew the pain of plastic surgery. These two were both child stars. I mean, at this point, David's a celebrity. He said, "He has been my friend throughout everything that I've been through. And he's my only friend that I can say has been there for me always." There is a really great Medium article that I do have linked in the show notes, and they talk a lot about David's relationship with Michael Jackson. David discusses that Michael was actually the first person to really talk to him about art. As a teenager, David starts realizing that he has this passion for art. He wanted to start to draw, to paint, but it wasn't going to be easy because they had to alter art supplies to fit David's hands. His fingertips had been amputated over these many surgeries. But he didn't care. He was going to learn. And yes, he did. And he grasped onto this new passion. He talked to the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and he told them about this day that he was hanging out with Michael Jackson at Neverland Ranch, and he was just painting. And Michael walked up to him and said, "You are the greatest artist in the world." David was only 13 when Charles was released from prison. And when his father was released, David told the LA Times, "I'd shoot his eye out if he ever came over. I'd blind him. He will be out there free. He probably has people out there right now looking for me, and I will have to live the rest of my life on the line, always looking behind me." David was always on the defense. He was a teenager. He was a kid, and he was scared to death that his father was coming to get him. He told this same LA Times reporter that he was practicing self-defense. He had escape routes. He had escape plans. He had a BB gun that he wanted to use for protection. He slept with that BB gun in his bed with him because he was so afraid that his father was going to come and find him. But by the time David reached age 19, he was done with this shit. He didn't want to do this anymore. He wanted closure. He wanted to be completely separated from his father. He wanted to just move on with his life. So, of course, Charles landed his ass back in prison. And David, at age 19, he requested a meeting with his father. He walked into that meeting. He walked straight up to his father, looked him in the face, and said, "Charles, you are not my father. You are an imposter. Parents, don't hinder their children from experiencing a normal childhood. I wish that you could experience the trauma and pain that I have gone through." David wanted to separate himself from his father, so he changed his name legally to Dave Dave. And in an interview with Larry King, Larry King asked, "Why did you choose the name Dave Dave?" And Dave Dave said, "To liberate myself from the confines of my father's criminality. He is a criminal, and he caused all of this. To free myself of his name and his legacy, I decided to become my own person through changing my name." And do you want to know what Charles Rothenberg did? He decided, "You know what? I'm going to change my name too." And in 1998, he went and changed his name to Charlie Charles. Dave Dave went on to do amazing things. He became an international artist. He became a DJ, a music producer, a rap musician. He directed a music video for Kelly Liddell. He focused on conceptual art in Las Vegas. Dave Dave's website stated that his creations create conceptual works that represents hope in an urban environment where oftentimes the struggles of life can be surpassed by the experience of living. Dave utilizes the belief in the concept of positivity in order to promote world peace. Dave Dave died at the age of 42 on July 15th, 2018, from complications of pneumonia. Dave Dave described himself as a survivor, not a victim. He said that there is a lot that happens in people's lives, but that doesn't define them as a human being. It only makes them stronger. Thank you so much for joining me here again on Residue. I cannot wait to see you again next week. And until then, stay safe and stay paranoid. Residue is created, hosted, written, researched, edited, and produced by me, Chrissy Champagne. Do not forget to hit that follow button, and I will see you soon.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.